Welcome to the Free to Choose Media Podcast. Today's podcast is titled Globalization and the Emergence of the Entrepreneurial Economy. Recorded in 1999, Dr. David B. Ottrich, Emeritech Chair of Economic Development and Director, Institute for Developmental Strategies, Indiana University, and Dr. A. Roy Thurick, Professor of Industrial Economics at Erasmus University, Rotterdam, discuss the impact of globalization and the emergence of the entrepreneurial economy. We hope you enjoy today's episode, and don't forget to subscribe to the Free to Choose Media Podcast.
Well, good afternoon, Roy. It's a pleasure to see you again, as always, and I'm delighted that you've come in from Europe, from the Netherlands, to talk with me about this fascinating and important subject about the impact of globalization and the emergence of the entrepreneurial economy. And, you know, I think it's particularly fortuitous we meet in this first week in the new millennium. It gives us a chance to look back and think about how the economies evolved and developed in the last century and towards the end of the last century. And, you know, I know, Roy, you and I both feel that the kind of growth that's occurred in the United States, the kind of wealth that's been created in this country was unimaginable a decade ago at the end of the 1980s, the beginning of the 1990s. During the Gulf War in 1991, this country was in a recession. Things were stagnant. People were a little bit depressed, concerned about where their jobs, where their futures were. Within just a few short years, and you probably feel this coming from Europe, you get this sense of just confidence, exuberance here, and that nobody anticipated. Let me ask you, what surprises you about this growth that the United States has experienced this decade? Does anything strike you as being particularly unexpected?
I think the surprising fact is that this growth probably doesn't just come from the strength and the innovative power of the large incumbent corporations who've been always very powerful in this part of the world, but also from a huge amount of small entrepreneurial firms who entered the market and who create variety, and by this variety create some sort of selection process so that new products in a new wave of technological opportunities come to the market. That's what you see and feel here in America, especially, of course, in the area of hard and software. But to have a clear image of what's going on in America, it also pays to look at what's going to happen and what is happening in Europe, because there is a set of experiments going on. I mean, Europe is not just a homogeneous country like North America is. It's an experiment where 20 or 25 countries are doing their own thing. And if you look at the variety in developments and in sets of policies in Europe, when you look at that, then you are becoming aware of the fact that it's a small American firm which contributes to the enormous increase of prosperity here. If you look at Europe, for instance, and you see that there's countries which are more successful than others. Ireland, which has had a somewhat backward economy, but now it's become very successful. My own country, the Netherlands, which was a forward economy, and now is even more successful than
it has been. We all know about the famous Dutch disease of what, the 1970s and 1980s.
We made a mess of it.
And somehow the Dutch disease has turned into the Dutch miracle. Yeah.
We made a mess of it. But let me tell you, it's been the politicians who've had to face the blame for this. But it was also the large companies of the Netherlands. I mean, you're well aware that the Netherlands is hosting the headquarters of some of the largest global companies like Philips
sure.
Unilever, and Royal Dutch, and some others. So in the Netherlands have always had a large number of multinationals per square meter. And there was enormous faith that these companies would contributes to the future prosperity of the Netherlands, up to a point that they started exporting their employment to the low-wage countries. And the final blow was in by the end of the 80s when Eastern Europe opened up. Yeah. So these large companies started exporting employment to the neighboring countries of Eastern Europe. And that created an enormous hole in the employment constellation of the Netherlands.
Jobs,
yeah. So at that time, there was an influx of cheap labor. And those who were well educated had very good training in large companies and didn't know what to do because their jobs were lost. And a lot of these people then entered the entrepreneurial world, set up companies of their own. Yeah. And that gave an enormous revival, rejuvenation of the Dutch economy.
In the 1990s.
In the 1990s, early 1990s. So when you look at that example and others in Europe, you have a clear image of what's going on in America. My question now to you is...
So you can see the places that have... grown the most in the 1990s and created the most numbers of jobs and pushed ahead are those countries that have generated a lot of new firms and small firms, like the Netherlands, Ireland,
Sweden, Spain. Yeah. And these countries are all in a different phase of development. Mm. Of course, Sweden and the Netherlands are more modern than Ireland and Spain. Mm-hmm. But despite the stage of economic development, an entrepreneurial energy can help enormously to take the place of the large companies, which either shrink or transport their employment elsewhere in the world.
Well, let me pick up on a point you said, because it sounds quite analogous to what we've experienced in the United States. And that was about the loss of jobs or shifting of jobs out of companies like Philips to elsewhere in the globe. You know, it used to be in this country back during the Cold War period, in any case, 1950s, 1960s, even going into the 1970s, that the competitiveness of a place like Detroit was tightly linked, almost indistinguishable from the competitiveness of the firms in the place. So in the case of Detroit, it was the auto industry. And someone once said, what's good for General Motors is good for America. That was a little debated. But nobody ever questioned what was good for General Motors was good for Detroit. If General Motors did well, the workers in Detroit did well. They earned a good paycheck. They went out and spent that money in the shops in Detroit, in the suppliers, and the city, the region prospered. It's not just true for the auto industry. It was true for Pittsburgh in steel. It was true for tires in Akron, Ohio. And it sounds to me like you're saying this was also the case of Philips, say, in the Netherlands. And what's interesting is, in elsewhere in the globe, I know, say, for Germany, we had the sense of Siemens, Volkswagen, Lufthansa, Daimler-Benz. These were German companies, and as long as the companies did well, people in Germany did well. What's made this change? Why has this changed from the, say, 50s, 60s, 70s, maybe even 80s?
But this is an entirely different era. Huh? This is, some would call this era the management economy.
Huh? The era I'd describe.
And there's at least two things. First, it's an era of stability, homogeneity, and continuity. So large firms can set up large investments and can profit out of the scale economies, which occur in the area of R&D or production or even distribution. They safe, long, well-balanced technological trajectories. That's what companies like Philips or IBM did. Mm-hmm. They set up a portfolio of products and knew in advance that for a decade or so, these products would be bought. They created the market. They created the market and then were in a position to pay good salaries to good workers. And if these salaries of these workers go up, then the opportunity cost for those gifted people to become self-employed or to set up their own business, they
Why would you leave
there's no entrepreneurial energy in incentive. So there's two things. One, it's scale economies based upon continuity and stability. And second, there is no entrepreneurial energy because it's embedded in these large companies. That's what was happening
in the managed economy.
In the managed economy, that was happening in the south of the Netherlands, where Philips had an enormous share of the labor market.
That's why no major
accidents happened when Philips started shrinking, because all these gifted people, they started setting up their own companies. That's why cities like Detroit are still thriving. I mean, the big automobile companies still are big and powerful, but nevertheless they've shrunk enormously. And cities like Detroit are thriving. The rubber city of Akron is still thriving. Yeah.
But you know, it's interesting. A decade ago, 15, 20 years ago, they were not thriving. And that seems to be when the change occurred, when we had this disjuncture between the competitiveness of these large firms, these large corporations like Ford and General Motors, U.S. Steel, and the competitiveness of the places where the firms found that in order to maintain their competitiveness, they had to leave that location and go someplace else. So what you're really saying, it was the advent of globalization in the last 10 or 15 years that has really caused a disjuncture between the well-being or the competitiveness of the companies and the competitiveness of the places. You know, back in what you call the managed economy, General Motors or Ford didn't really have options or a lot of options to do a lot of production elsewhere around the globe. I mean, Europe in the was ravaged by war. Of course, they set up a fair number of plants in Western Europe. Eastern Europe it wasn't politically feasible. Eastern Europe was under the sphere of influence of the Soviet Union. Asia was very volatile. China was volatile. South America was very volatile. So even from a political stability perspective, investments on most of the globe were not feasible. One of the interesting phenomena of the fall of the Berlin Wall a decade ago was that it made investments in production outside of Western Europe and North America politically viable and therefore economically attractive. That may have been one of the big causes of this disjuncture between the competitiveness of large corporations and competitiveness of places. And of course, there's probably something else happened in the last 10 or 15 years too, right?
You use the word globalization, but that's a very dangerous word. I mean, everybody uses it. Even politicians use the word. It's a buzzword. I mean, we have a certain feeling, but we do not know exactly what it means.
How would you define it?
It means several things at the same time. What's very important is the demise of the socialist economies. That meant that a lot of energy and a lot of capital could now be spent on other things than on the huge military complex. Mm. That opened up energy for doing other things. Second thing is, at the end of the managed economy, there was an enormous amount of prosperity. And this prosperity now was being invested not in homogeneous products, but more and more consumers wanted to have more and more different things. Mm. A variety of demand was created. And in a world of variety of demand, there is no use of scale economies. Mm. I mean, scale economies even obstruct further growth in prosperity because the consumers do not just want identical products.
What did Henry Ford say? He said he can give the consumer any color car he wants as long as it's black. As he was inventing the assembly line, that's your point.
And the thing, and Lancia, an Italian car manufacturer, now advertises with, you can have any color because it will be another color as in the car of your neighbor. They guarantee that
it'll be different.
Only one color. Yeah. So that's another aspect of this huge buildup of prosperity. This buildup has been made in a managed economy, but now the entrepreneurial one, the new economy, thrives on it.
You know, when you talked about globalization, you said, well, it's certainly a cliche and thrown around. You know, you're right to emphasize one element of it is the political stability in the much of the world, which has made it feasible. And the other, of course, is a decrease in the cost of transferring economic activity out of one location to another location, which has an awful lot to do with the telecommunications revolution. You know, when you and I were boys, I mean, you were in the you're on one side of the Atlantic Ocean and I was on the other side of the Atlantic Ocean. Communication was possible, but it typically went by letters, I would suppose, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And it would take weeks to communicate. And of course, telephone for the wealthy was possible. But we know now with the internet, it's it makes it possible to transmit information at zero marginal cost across geographic space.
Incredible.
What that means, the cost of taking a plant, this has happened in Bloomington, Indiana, where I live, where a Thomson Electronic plant actually closed recently and has opened up in Mexico, where the workers are earning, I guess, $4 an hour. It's not possible for workers to compete against those kind of wages. So you really have two driving forces of globalization. One is it's politically feasible to locate in other parts of the globe.
Yeah.
And the second is that it's economically feasible. The cost of taking economic activity across geographic space has gone down to zero. You know, people always ask this question, and I guess I'd ask it to you, Roy, which, if that's true, why don't our wages in, say, the Netherlands or Europe or here in the United States, North America, why don't they converge down? Why aren't they pulled down by the Mexicos of the world, by the Hungries of the world? Why don't you get this downward pull on wages? Or why doesn't all economic activity shift out of the Netherlands or Germany or Europe to Poland? And what's your answer to that?
For my answer, I have to introduce a third concept, and that's uncertainty. I mean, you talked about globalization. One aspect of globalization is that everybody's going to deal with others wherever in the world.
Right.
And you can shift input and output factors all around the globe. And that creates some sort of uncertainty. You never know where the next product is going to come from. You never know what the next product is going to be, because there's variety in demand. You have a different shirt from what I have. And if we have an interview next week, we both have other shirts. So there we have to deal with unfaithful consumers, not only in the cross-section sense, but also in the time serial sense. Yeah. So also in the area of demand, there's uncertainty. Mm. And then there's uncertainty in the area of technological developments. I mean, a huge wave of products is overwhelming the world. Huh? One of the reasons I am here in North America is to set up a joint seminar with you. Last year, we couldn't have dreamt about setting up a joint seminar, which is enabled by new technological things. So the concept of uncertainty is pivotal in explaining why activities center in certain highly developed, highly trained parts of the world.
Because they can deal with uncertainty better.
They have insights
that will help give a better outcome to uncertain situations. What a lot of people call knowledge-based or idea-based economic activity. And, you know, I have two examples, though, for your, you know, we talk about the uncertainty of demand and the uncertainty of technology. And I recall that when IBM really dominated the computer industry, when I studied in graduate school, the most pressing policy issue in the late 1970s was, should we break up IBM or not before they take over the U.S. computer industry? Well, they already had, and possibly the world. And nobody foresaw, either at IBM or in the academic community among economists, nobody seemed to foresee the advent of companies like Apple, Microsoft, Intel. We all seemed to assume that IBM would continue its dominance. And part of the reason why these companies were created and thrived is that they offered different kinds of products than IBM, personal computer from Apple, and then, of course, software from Microsoft, microprocessor from Intel. They offered different kinds of products that IBM didn't anticipate. And when IBM had the chance to produce and sell these products, they reached the decision that There was no demand. It wasn't profitable to produce these products. It's a great story where Ted Hoff, a guy named Ted Hoff, invented the microprocessor at IBM. And microprocessor is useful in a, of course, in a chip. And IBM didn't think that there would be any profit in that. So Hoff actually left the company, went to Intel, and the rest is history. Same thing when Steven Jobs went to IBM, along with 16 or 17 other corporations, and said, look, let's produce a personal computer. We can make some money at this. And IBM evaluated the project and thought that there's no profit to be made. And, you know, so those are examples that really illustrate your point of dealing with uncertainty is involves knowledge, ideas, the evaluation of new ideas. And that's what's very difficult to ship out to other locations on the globe.
Yeah.
So it sounds like our comparative advantage in Europe and in North America is increasingly shifting away from unskilled, repetitious, routinized types of activities and shifting towards, as you say, dealing with uncertainty, which means idea-based, knowledge-based, where you have to have some kind of understanding, some kind of context, and it's not something that you can transmit over the internet to Southeast Asia or to South America. And that's why we haven't seen wages go down, say in Europe and North America, especially for skilled labor and for human capital, right? Yeah. And we know in Silicon Valley, for example, they've created millions of new jobs, and wages keep going up there.
Yeah, the average wage rate is going up, but also the inequality and the skewness of the wage distribution is going up, because those who are better in absorbing uncertainty get higher wages or a higher residual income as an entrepreneur than those who can't. I mean, and that's what you see in Europe, despite decades of policies aimed at bringing down wage inequality.
Yeah. It's interesting. So in a world where you've got some knowledge workers and some workers who are not able to participate in the knowledge economy, you find a divergent gap. Certainly in this country, we know that the income distribution has widened dramatically in the last decade, but you say also in Europe.
Also in Europe.
Despite the policies to try to keep income distribution. And this seems to be one of the challenges, I suppose, as we move into this entrepreneurial economy. Well, it's interesting because you've identified that as a result of globalization, you know, you've identified two forces, driving forces of globalization, which really were the catalyst for destroying the managed economy. The managed economy was built on stability, predictability, routinized types of activities. It's interesting growing up in the managed economy in this country. I remember as a child, my report card from first grade, I was graded or evaluated on categories like gets along well with others, is reliable, does what he's told, obeys the rules. It's clear what kinds of values were important in the managed economy. People who did what they were told, they went into existing situations, followed the rules, and were basically cogs in a machine, because that economy knew what had to be produced and knew the kinds of products and knew how to produce them, more or less. It even knew what kind of firms would produce them and what kind of workers. So we had this machine of predictability going on. Yeah. The managed economy was about doing this, as you said, exhausting scale economies as much as possible. And when you think back to the managed economy, it really required different types of people and capabilities than what you call the entrepreneurial economy does. But it's interesting, Roy, because you seem to identify the managed economy was ended because of globalization, largely. which meant that the high wage economies of Western Europe, North America, no longer had a comparative advantage in routinized types of economic activity. Yeah. Instead, it shifted to knowledge.
It's surprising how quick the answer came, how quick the organization of this old economy was reshaped into a new economy. Mm. I mean, in some countries, it's quicker than in other countries. But it's surprising. Yeah? Now, look at my country again. Mm. Some 10 years ago, the average number of new entrepreneurs, new shop owners or business owners was 25,000 a year, and now it's more than 50,000 a year. Of course, they do not all survive, but that's not the point. I mean, it's the influx of this energy. It's so quick, and it's so you can get very optimistic when you look at these figures. Also, you can get very optimistic if you realize what the reasons why the unification of Europe was set in action in the early 70s. I mean, Europe wanted to have an answer as a home market for global firms. Europe wanted to have an answer to global firms as General Motors or IBM or McDonald's or whatever. Europe had no home base for its own global players. I mean, you had Philips and Siemens and some automobile companies, but they were midgets or backward compared to their American counterparts. That more or less, or basically, was the argument for setting up a new unified Europe. Mm. I mean, and
create a large
domestic.
That's
not the point anymore. I mean, you can get very optimistic about the future of Europe because in Europe there's more diversity within these 20 or so countries than there is in North America. We do not use this diversity and this heterogeneity yet to a point where we can thrive upon it. But it's an easy prediction that this diversity creates more new products, more new ideas, more new services than it will in North America. And that's why you see that despite all the old policies which are still maintained in Europe of old politicians, the growth rates are year on year better than whatever bureau predicts. Yeah. The question is, will the question we have to face is, will our industry, the academic industry, will be able to be confronted with this change? Will it change too? I mean, business school and economics departments have thrived upon educating people for the managed economy, marketing people or finance people. Who would be the future collaborators, employment in these large companies and large departments? What will our industry do in training people to absorb uncertainty and to get acquainted with entrepreneurship, whatever entrepreneurship may be? Mm. Yeah. I think that's one of the biggest challenges of Europe, not only of our industry, but if you're right in creating your image of the knowledge economy, and if I'm right when creating the image of the economy of uncertainty, then those who are going to take a big part in it have to be well trained. And I see very little movements towards reshaping of the education system in Europe. There is some scattered entrepreneurship courses, there are some scattered initiatives, but not as massive as should be.
Well, I'm not sure that the situation's any better at all or much better in the United States. There's certainly there's been an explosion of courses on managing small business, which must be in the right direction. And I have to report that several years ago, my young son in first grade was taking Saturday courses at Georgia State University in Atlanta on Saturday mornings, and I think he took rocks for urban dwellers, where they went along and looked at whatever rocks they could find. There was chess and French, and one of the courses was starting your own business for seven-year-olds. I'm not sure you'd find that in Europe.
Absolutely.
That's an interesting point. Certainly, we in the economics profession are challenged about how to think and how to understand and analyze an economy where change is the driving force of value creation rather than stability. And our intellectual roots may be more in the tradition of Schumpeter, who had a focus on the dynamic process of firms being created and destroyed, creative destruction, as you mentioned before. But when I think back to my own graduate education at the University of Wisconsin, with a specialty on industry, our focus was exclusively on large corporations. And I think that we, sure, this reflected the managed economy where most of the important value that was created, the source of competitiveness, was in the existing status quo corporations. No one then seemed to anticipate that entire industries would become regenerated, like the computer industry, but not just the computer industry. Also, new industries like biotechnology would emerge from firms that didn't exist, create fields that didn't even exist. And all this is driven by small and new firms. Let me ask you, Roy, though, you know, because you brought up that small and new firms are an important element of a knowledge-based economy. Why is that? Why do we observe small and new firms being playing such an important role in a knowledge-based economy where there's a lot of uncertainty?
That's their capability of absorbing uncertainty. And it may lead to a very difficult situation for individuals, of course. I mean, going broke or having a bad experience in the latest venture. But all these micro experiences, which can be dreadful for individuals, they lead to the selection process where new products are being created. And basically, this is a better feedback ground for newness than large, massive investments of major corporations.
You know, that's right. I guess what we've learned in our research in the last decade or so is that in a large bureaucratic organization, it's difficult to reach agreement about ideas that are uncertain. Yeah. When somebody has an idea to do something different, make a new kind of product, you may think your idea is valuable, but it's not clear your boss will find that idea valuable, or your boss's boss. Yeah. And of course, this is what happened. This is not a new phenomenon. When Chester Carlson invented the copy machine, he went to Kodak and said, "Let's this is a valuable machine." And Kodak said, "Well, you know, we don't think you can make a lot of money. We don't think it's a valuable idea. There's not a lot of value there. In any case, we're in the business of photography, not copy machines." In the end, Carlson had to start a firm, Xerox, and the rest is history. Mm-hmm. But I think that illustrates that in a world where ideas and new ideas are the source of competitiveness and value, that you're going to get different evaluation of those ideas. And the question is, what do people do when they think they've got a good, valuable idea, but their boss and their boss's boss don't value it the same way? One answer is they do nothing. They keep their mouth shut and keep working. Another answer is if they have alternatives, they start a firm. And this seems to be why we see, as you said before, those countries in Europe that have generated a lot of new firms and small firms seem to have grown more because those new firms are the mechanism to inject those ideas. And if you somehow cut off those ideas, the economy loses a lot of the potential innovation. And certainly, this may be part of the reason why we thought that we were experiencing convergence between the East and the West, the Soviet Union and the United States, back in the late 1950s, early 60s. But by the 1980s, it was clear we were experiencing divergence,
right,
because the West seemed to be able to accommodate these new ideas, where the East, which was really the system of production, was based on combines. It wasn't really possible to start new firms. If you had an idea to do something different, you could either do it within the existing organization, but anytime there were differences in evaluation, you really didn't have the alternative unless you wanted to try to come over the Berlin Wall, which some people did. Well, what as we move towards closing up, how has this changed policy, public policy towards business between the managed economy and this new entrepreneurial economy?
How has this changed?
How was public policy different, say, in the managed economy than what we've got in the entrepreneurial economy?
I would say the basic words are here enabling versus constraining.
Enabling in the entrepreneurial economy
and
constraining in the... Why was it? How was it constraining and why was it constraining in the managed economy?
There was
economy?
A continuous fear for the evil parts of the evil face of the monopolies, the evil face of large companies. Everybody knew that the future and new products and prosperity lay in the hands of large companies.
Mm.
But it had a flip side. It was the evil face of monopoly.
So I read someplace that Philips, for example, accounted for, 4% of employment in the Netherlands? One company.
Probably more.
Probably more at one point. And it was such an influential company.
Yeah.
So the thinking must have been the Netherlands needed the power and the efficiency of a company like Philips. At the same time, it was feared.
Of course, that
it, so it had to be constrained.
Right, yeah.
And those instruments of constraint were what in the Netherlands? They're probably regulation, right?
Yeah, not so much in the Netherlands, because the Netherlands is a small country with open borders. So it's very difficult to exploit in an evil fashion monopoly power there, because it's open.
It's a global company.
Yeah, it's a global company. But look at countries like Germany. I mean, they have a antitrust law, which has been very effective and also very detailed for a lot of years. And it mainly meant to maintain an intense conversation between the unions and the large companies.
Right.
And that again meant that
so the unions,
new partners, were outside the countervailing power
Count,
process.
Right.
It's all a Galbraithian image of the countervailing power between big labor, big government, and big business,
and big business,
where there's no room for new and small companies.
You know, under the Swedish model and the French model, government ownership of firms. I mean, these were national firms. Seemed to be an important mechanism for constraining the power of these large-scale enterprises, where we needed the efficiency in the scale economies, but we were afraid of the political power and social power that, left to themselves, these companies could unleash on society. The United States seemed to rely a little bit more maybe on antitrust during the managed economy, but certainly regulation. We had whole entire industries. Airlines was regulated, trucking was regulated, financial services was regulated, industry after industry was regulated. So it seemed like there were three major instruments of constraint: public ownership, which we saw in the Swedish model, the French model, regulation, which we saw more in the UK and in the Germany. And then antitrust, which was probably the most enforced in the United States. But certainly we saw elements of all three in the United States and in most countries. Okay. Now let's talk about the entrepreneurial economy. You said something about policies of enablement.
Yeah, enablement.
How does that differ from these policies of constraint?
Policies of enablement mainly focus on lowering entry barriers. Mm. You need very little permits to do whatever business you want. That's one. It also has to do with information, and information has to do with stimulating the absorption of uncertainty or stimulation of entrepreneurship in industries like ours, and education. It has to do with lowering the risks of exit. I mean, you cannot imagine the difference there is between the stigma when your business fails in Europe versus the stigma here in this country.
Mm.
I mean, in this country, if you interview and you reveal that in one of the former occupations you had. You had a business and you failed. It doesn't work against you. In Europe still, it works against you. And also the financial burdens of failing business can follow you for your entire private life in some European countries.
Maybe this is why I read in the German newspapers a few years ago, towards the beginning of the decade, I must have read it 15 times, if Bill Gates were German, there'd be no Microsoft.
Probably
because
not.
Of all these barriers to entrepreneurship. And what you're talking about in enabling policies are to reduce these barriers, to create knowledge, and to commercialize it. You know, when I think of this country, at least, but this is true all around Western Europe as well now. There's a big emphasis on creating knowledge in the form of research at universities, transferring that knowledge, commercializing that knowledge, generating small firms, small businesses. And what's interesting is that the policies of constraint, at least in this country, were at the federal level. They were undertaken by the antitrust division, by the regulatory agencies. And of course, we've witnessed a downsizing in Washington, D.C., these federal agencies, which I think has led some of our colleagues in the economics profession to misinterpret the downsizing of the government. But in fact, that's really those agencies. At the same time, what we've seen in the local, the city level, the state level, is a whole new set of institutions oriented towards upgrading the skills, the knowledge capabilities of the population in those cities and states, towards commercializing knowledge and towards starting new businesses, helping those businesses
grow.
That's
also a form of variety.
In what sense?
Yeah, in the sense that it's not the central government anymore which sets the regimes of policies, but it's left to local authorities to do their own thing and to create a variety.
So, for example,
a lot of these local authorities, they aim at setting up clusters and networks of firms and enabling policy, not stimulating specific businesses, but stimulating businesses to work together and create an infrastructure for that. That's what you see in England and in the Netherlands and France, for instance. And that can be very successful. And the example of successful policies in parts of the country can be followed easily and swiftly in other parts. Mm. So that's, again, a form of selection and the diffusion of the good examples.
Of best practices and policy.
Best practices.
So we're seeing a lot of local policies oriented towards generating new businesses. Because it's these new businesses, as you were saying before, in small businesses that have generated most of the new jobs in most of the countries in Europe and the United States. Well, Roy, I think this pretty well summarizes the transformation that you and I have worked on the transformation from the managed economy in the post-war period to this entrepreneurial economy that seems to have started right at the end of the last century, but is clearly the trajectory we're on in this new century. And I, for one, don't know where this will take us. I don't know about you.
I have no idea where it will take us. That's part of the uncertainty.
That's part of the uncertainty. But it's been a pleasure talking with you, as always.
My pleasure entirely.
Want more episodes like this? Don't forget to subscribe and get updates each week for the Free to Choose Media Podcast.